Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 5th, 2006, and this is show number 33. Well, let's start right off with our new country update. It is slowing down. We're kind of running out of countries to add, but we still have three new countries, or territories at least, listening to the NoSillaCast. This week, we gained the Cayman Islands, Peru, and Venezuela. Welcome to all the new listeners. As always, don't crash your car trying to write down all the links I talk about. They're all duly recorded in my show notes, so just relax and listen. Well, I got to do a Samsung update. Those of you who've been playing along with our home game will remember my seven-month trial with Samsung trying to get them to give me money back for broken monitors they sent to me. Well, the last update that I gave was that they gave me a second check for the same amount as the first one, and I was going to cash that and cash in and then send them the difference back of what they didn't owe me. But it was too good to be true. Of course, the check did bounce. I knew that could happen, but it was worth the $5 I had to pay. So, well, now I'm up $55 to have never received a working monitor from Samsung. Well, it was worth a try. I had to run the risk, but I want to let you know that you still shouldn't buy anything from Samsung if you can possibly avoid it. As unhappy as I was with Samsung and how they treated me when things went wrong, and remember, things always go wrong. It's not that I got broken monitors that even bothers me. It's the fact that they ended up stealing $50 from me for the fun of having two broken monitors. But I thought it'd be good to give a little bit of a contrast of a company that does stand by their work when something goes wrong. I bought an iBook for my daughter for graduation in June of 2005. There was a $100 rebate through Amazon. Well, I keep pretty accurate records of my rebates because I'm an anal engineer and I've got a nice little spreadsheet and all that stuff. So I realized a little while ago that I never got my rebate. So I wrote an email to customer service. They wrote back in about 2 days, apologized, asked if I could send the information again, which was good because now I have a reason for why I have that gigantic folder with all the darn photocopies I've been making all these years of these rebates. I sent it in again, and I got my $100 back very, very quickly. So, you know, again, stuff goes wrong. It's all in how you're treated when it does go wrong. Speaking of rebates, I'd like to give a little bit of advice on those. I used to be one of the people that would race out and do the $100 rebate deals at CompUSA and places like that. But I started keeping this spreadsheet to see what percentage I actually got back. I was running about 60 to 70% return on my rebates. I noticed that the ones to places like wheresmyrebate.com virtually never came back. They'd send me an email saying things like, "Your request for a rebate has been denied." No explanation or any kind of recourse, nobody you could write to, nothing you could do. And of course, I had photocopies of all the garbage and the work that I'd done. So a couple of years ago, I made a new policy. From now on, I only do manufacturers' rebates, like HP or Nikon, that kind of thing, or Apple. And since I changed that policy, I'm running 100%. And those rebates aren't usually the 6 to 8 week thing either. If you do an HP or Nikon rebate, those kind of things, they tend to be maybe 2 or 3 weeks kind of numbers. So consider this when you look at those rebates, whether you're really going to do it or not. If you're really not going to do it, just don't even pretend you're going to do it. Don't even make yourself think that you're going to do it, because it's so prevalent that people don't return rebates that last year TiVo had better than expected revenue because so many people didn't do the $100 rebates they're offering. Of course, I did mine and I got my $100 back. I had a lot of fun email from listeners this week. It was really a blast. I was able to connect up Susan with Slough. The two of them are both working on solutions for the visually impaired. So it felt really good to be able to put the two of these guys together, and I bet they're going to come up with some really great work. The reason I know that we have Peru on our list of new countries is I got a great email from Paul, who's a student and listens down there. It was really fun to hear from him and hear how he listens to the NoSillaCast, and he told me that he does laugh at my jokes, so that's always good, so I'll be keeping that up. Listener Steve wrote in, had a really good question. He enjoys a podcast called Japanese Pod 101, but when it comes into his iTunes, it's not in the podcast section, and he wondered why. I explained that there are tags on the MP3 files that tell iTunes what the different songs are. If you click on one of my podcasts, do a get info on it with the command or control I, and then click on the info tab, you'll see a pull down at the bottom called genre, and the tag in my case has been set to podcast. It's a little confusing because there's podcasts and there's podcast. I'm not sure if it matters, but I get paralyzed every time I look at it. The other thing that needs to be done is for the actual feed to have the correct iTunes tags. Unfortunately, Apple decided to make up a bunch of their own tags that are not standard. So there were all these great standard MP3 tags, and Apple said, well, we're going to have our own. And so they came up with these specialized tags. I took a look at Japanese 101's RSS feed, and they're not using any iTunes tags at all. The other advantage for them is that if they use the standard tags, their podcast would be available in the directory in iTunes. For example, I have a tag that identifies my podcast as being about technology, so if you look in the iTunes directory, it will find my podcast under technology. I took a look at this Japanese 101 podcast, and they had listed their genre as education, so they weren't actually even in the podcast genre. The way I get my podcast tags correct is I use a fabulous program called Feeder from Reinvented Software that does all the work for me. But, you know, once you look at a feed that has the info in it correctly, it's pretty easy to follow along and just plug it in if you don't have a tool to do it for themselves. Jeremy is a listener from England, and he asked if there's a way to switch off the spell checker in Mail, because he apparently Mail hates British English. Oddly, accepts words like iPod and iTunes, but it does not know what podcast is yet. I think you can actually teach it, but his real question was how to turn off the spell checking. So it turns out you can shut it off if you go to Mail, Preferences, and then the Composing tab. There's a little pull down on check spelling till you get to the word never. So I sent him off a note on how to do that. I noticed that in the help that after OS 10.2, they did support multiple languages in spell check. But my question out to the audience is, does anyone know how to access the other languages' dictionaries? It's kind of a weird question, but of course Jeremy wants the real English dictionary, not the American dictionary. Not sure if they actually make that distinction, but I couldn't find it anywhere in there where I could choose a different language. Perhaps it's in the global language section or something. I know that Apple supports all these different languages, but other than when I first came in and said I speak English, I don't remember ever having opportunity to change that. So keep up all the email, guys. I love to hear from you, hear what your questions are, hear how you learned about the podcast, all kinds of things. It's a lot of fun. I got an interesting piece of feedback, actually, from my husband again. Good thing he listens and gives me these little tips. He said that when GarageBand converts the podcast over to iTunes, it actually cuts nearly a full second off of the beginning. So if you ever felt like you kind of came in the middle of the story, that's why. And I never realized that. So I'm now adding a full second of empty space at the beginning of the podcast to keep it from doing that. It seems to have fixed the effect, but I wonder why they did that in GarageBand. That's unfortunate. So I want to talk to you a little bit about favicons. Do you ever notice when you go to a sophisticated site like Yahoo that up in the address bar they have a big red Y for their icon next to the URL? They don't all have big red Ys. Yahoo has the big red Y, but Google has a G, that kind of thing. Well, that's actually called a favicon, and you'll be pleased to know that podfeet.com went through a massive upgrade this week, because now my little favicon is two little turquoise feet. I knew you'd were worried about this and wanted to see an enhancement like that. I created it by taking a small JPEG I'd created and using an auto-generating tool at dynamicdrive.com. I've got a picture in the show notes of how it works, but it's really easy. You click Choose File, and you give it the file to upload, and then it automatically creates this little file called a favicon.ico file. The little picture it makes is actually 16 by 16 pixel icon, so you got to be careful. You got to pick something with pretty distinct look when it's really, really small. If you're running a normal website, after you create this favicon.ico file, you just throw this little file into your root directory where the index.html file is. In a content management system like WordPress that I use to create the blog, it's a little trickier. I don't understand PHP at all, so I'm really winging it in there, and I can't even explain what I did to make it work, but I followed the directions at codex.wordpress.org/favicon.ico, and it seems to have worked, so I'm all excited about that. Let me finish my continue on with my MacBook Pro review. As you know, last week I did my opening salvo on what I thought of the new MacBook Pro. Firefox seems to be having some unfortunate weirdness in entering text into forms. I have to use Firefox to use WordPress to create my blog entries, and it wasn't working at all well last week. I had to keep saving the blog and then opening a new window and going back into Firefox to be able to type in the form windows. I even had trouble selecting the URL bar at one point. And I noticed that when mail was up, it seemed to get in front of Firefox and not let Firefox come back to the foreground when I clicked on it. I finally had to quit Firefox and reopen it to get it to work at all. One strange thing is some of these failures I've been having seem to just go away after a while. I wrote that little note about Firefox about 3 or 4 days ago, and I haven't had any trouble in Firefox ever since. And last week I wrote that Safari was quitting a lot, and Safari hasn't quit at all since then. Not really sure what that's about. These failures kind of come and go. The MacBook Pro makes a really funny little noise. It's a really little noise, and it's kind of hard to describe. It's kind of like a drive winding up and then winding back down, but subtler than that. It kind of goes, it's this weird little, and it's really, really quiet, but if it's quiet in the room, I notice it. It's kind of funny. There's another sound problem that research department Niraj looked into for me. He actually found out about it, and then I tested, and sure enough, it happens. But it's, if you have the screen brightness turned up all the way, everything's fine. If you turn the screen brightness down one little notch, it suddenly starts buzzing. It's just this zzz, and then you turn it back up full blast and it stops making the noise. I spent about 25 minutes trying to record this sound for you, but it's so quiet. My mic couldn't pick it up. And I tried a bunch of cool things I learned about in GarageBand, like how you can duplicate a track. So you're kind of adding the tracks to increase the amplitude. I played around with compression. I did everything I could think of to get it to be loud enough, but you could just barely hear it. And I figured it'd be more fun to hear me go zzz and just do it that way. So that'll be interesting to see if they come out with any kind of fix on that. Let's see. The problem with the network card and voiceover IP is getting really old. I described this last week, but basically there's a problem with the NIC card in the MacBook Pro if you're using it on a voiceover IP network. And there's a really long technical explanation of it, but from what I can figure, it looks like the voiceover IP packets are actually interfering with the network on the MacBook Pro. So that's really unfortunate because that means I have to work wireless at work. And that's worked out okay because I've been near my office and there is a wireless access point near my office, but I tend to roam a lot. And if I'm anyplace else, I basically won't be able to browse the web at all. Again, it still seems to only affect web browsing. It doesn't seem to have much of an effect on mail or chat or anything like that. So maybe I could limp along with it. But I would like to see them fix that. And I've been watching for an upgrade pretty soon. The only good news about that is the wireless access on the MacBook Pro is significantly better than on the aluminum PowerBook. So I think I might have told you last week that my buddy Ron and I tested the aluminum PowerBook antenna right next to the MacBook Pro, and the MacBook Pro was getting a better signal, so that was good. I did read somewhere that they had moved the wireless antenna in the MacBook Pro to improve performance, so that evidently worked. I thought it was just me, but the two-fingered scrolling seems to get weird sometimes. Especially in Microsoft Office products. In fact, it might only be in Microsoft Office products. I've seen it in Word and in Excel, but when you're trying to use the two-fingered scroll to scroll down in a document, it just kind of jitters. It kind of goes up and down and up and down and doesn't actually make any progress. So I was thinking that was just me or just some weird effect. I wasn't really paying attention, but I was vindicated when I read David Pogue's review of the MacBook Pro in the New York Times Online, and he had noted the same thing, so it's not just me. When I first tried to use my new Samsung USB condenser mic on the MacBook Pro, it didn't work at all. They have a little applet that is necessary to make it work on the aluminum PowerBook, and it wouldn't work at all. So I emailed them, and they said to call. I was really annoyed because I just don't like calling people on the phone anymore because I prefer to communicate on my own schedule instead of theirs. So, you know, they're open from 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock Eastern time, and I'm on the West Coast of in California, and it's just, you know, you can never call when you want to call. It was a big hassle. I didn't want to call. But fine, I called them, and they answered right away. Like, no phone system to push one and then a pound or anything like that. This nice woman transferred me immediately to tech support, who also answered right away. No push pound, no what kind of unit are you working on, nothing like that, just gets on there. But here's where it gets really weird. The guy knew exactly how to fix the problem. He had me delete everything to do with our little applet. He knew what libraries to look in and what files to delete. You know, he knew the Mac operating system perfectly, knew exactly what little things to get rid of. And then he told me that as soon as I got rid of all of it, including a kernel extension, and rebooted, the mic would work fine. And you know what? It did. I'm doing my first recording on the MacBook Pro, and I just can't tell you, I was really happy with the company Samsung for their effect there. Their customer service was outstanding. Keep remembering it's Samsung, S-A-M-S-O-N, not to be confused with Samsung, and we don't do business with them. Well, I've got a little hardware tool you might be interested in. Walter Mossberger, the Wall Street Journal, did a review of a product that really might interest you. It's a small piece of hardware that will back up your cell phone. If you're not running a smartphone like a Trio or a BlackBerry, you probably have tons of phone numbers in your phone that you won't have written down anywhere. A lot of people have trouble with this, where they get their phone stolen, or they drop it in the toilet, or whatever, or they get a new phone and they can't transfer the data. The device that he reviewed is called the CellStick, C-E-L-L-S-T-I-K, from Spark Technology Corporation. It plugs into your cell phone, and it allows you to do the backup with the push of a button. The CellStick is the same size as a thumb drive, with a USB connector on one end and a connector to the phone on the other end. You don't have to use the CellStick with a computer, but if you want to edit the phone book on a computer, you can plug the CellStick into a Windows PC and mess around with your data there, and then put them back into the phone. If you're not using that, you just plug this little USB device into your phone, and on the face of the drive, there's two triangular buttons. One is pointing to the phone and one to the USB connector. This is done to make it really obvious whether you're pushing data to the phone or backing up from the phone. Of course, the buttons are labeled too, but I really like the triangular buttons because it really showed, you know, this is exactly what we're doing. We're going this way or we're going that way. And I don't know, I'm 47 years old and I have a little trouble seeing things anyway, so having a big button on it with the right direction seemed to be like a good idea to me. The CellStick is only $40 and it works with AudioVox, Kyocera, LG, Motorola, Nokia, Samsung, Siemens, and Sony Ericsson. Well, it works with Samsung too, but you're not going to buy a Samsung phone, so that's unimportant. If you're interested, check out the website at sparktech.com. That's sparktech.com, to see if your model of phone is on the list. I think this looks useful for a lot of people. Little Excel trick. This might not excite you, but I am just so excited about this. It's such a little thing, but it's really been bugging me. Ages ago, Microsoft took out the ability to insert a line with a keystroke. It used to be a command I, or in Windows, it would be a control I, meant insert. Well, out of the blue, they decided that Excel needed to conform to all the other applications where command I or control I means italics. Well, I need to do italics about once every 3 months in Excel file. I need to do an insert about 20 times a day. I would really like to have that on a keystroke. So it's just been bugging the daylights out of me ever since they got rid of it. And I hate going over and getting the mouse and going up and pull down, right click, all that stuff really bugs me. So this week I accidentally option clicked on a cell, and I meant to control click, but I actually did an option click instead, and the cell moved down. I can't believe this has been there all along and I just found it. Did you guys know about that and not tell me? Hate when that happens. Well, I bet you guys all knew, but I never knew, and I'm all excited. I'm not sure what button. I think maybe it's the Alt button on the PC is the same as the Option, but test that out and see if it helps you. That seems really stupid, but I really, really made me happy. Just so happy to find that. I'd like to do a book review next about Photoshop Elements. I'm a big fan of this software. This is the $80 US version of Photoshop for the rest of us. It's extremely capable software, but perhaps for many of us not completely intuitive. I wanted to get the most out of this software, so I purchased the book The Photoshop Elements 3 Book for Digital Photographers by Scott Kelby. This isn't a book about how to create digital art, but rather how to work with digital photos, as the title implies. Mr. Kelby says in his intro that this book is not for Mac people, but he underestimates its value to us. I'm sure most of you Mac users have figured out that if an author says hold down the control key, you know he just means to hold down the command key for the Mac users. Once you have that critically difficult issue set aside, The other thing to note about the book and the software is that the PC version is delivered with a great application that used to be called Photoshop Album, but Adobe has now built it into Photoshop Elements. The reason the Mac version doesn't come with it is that it provides the same kind of functionality we already get with iPhoto. The first couple of chapters of this book are dedicated to how to organize your photos in Photoshop Album, which is great for the Windows guys, because we all know how quickly a digital photo library can get out of control. Luckily, on the Mac side, we have iPhoto, so we're both taken care of. Once you get past those first couple of chapters, the book is completely operating system agnostic and a terrific resource. Let me first explain how I like to read a book like this where I've got to learn. I dedicate an hour every other week to reading, which makes the book take forever to absorb. I think it took me 9 months to read this. But I find that if I read too much at one time in a book like that, I don't remember a darn thing anyway. So this method gives me time to work with the new ideas I've learned, experiment, mark the pages for further reference. If it's a good book, I never lose the energy to keep going, even though there's those long gaps in between. To be truthful, I would do an hour a week if I could, but I can't seem to find the time, so every other week is all I can pull off. Mr. Kelby has a great sense of humor, which he uses in his introduction to each chapter. The chapters themselves are quite serious, but the introductions are hysterical. Let me read you the intro to chapter 10 to show you what I mean. Okay, this is a straight quote out of the book. Okay, I know you're thinking, hey, this is supposed to be a book for digital photographers. Why are we restoring old damaged photos taking 50 years before digital cameras were invented? Well, a secret loophole in my book contract enables me, once in every book, to cover a topic that does not fall within the general purview of the book. For example, in Photoshop CS Down and Dirty Tricks, I included a full chapter called Underrated Breakfast Cereals. So when you're working your way through this chapter, just keep thinking to yourself, hey, this could be another cereal chapter. Then you'll find not only does this chapter fit, but on some level, it also fits so well that it makes you want to fix yourself a huge bowl of Kellogg's Smart Start. Besides, there's another useful loophole. The theory that once a torn, washed-out, scratched photo of your great-grandfather is scanned, it then becomes a digital torn, washed-out, scratched photo of your great-grandfather. And once you open it in Elements 3, you'll be engulfed with a burning desire to repair that photo. If I hadn't included this chapter on how to repair and restore these old photos, then where would you be, Mr. Hey, this is supposed to be a book for digital photographers, frumpy pants? Don't you feel just a little guilty? I thought so. Now put down your spoon and start restoring some photos. Note, my publisher told me that if I found a way to work the phrase burning desire into the book, it would increase sales by as much as 7%. If that somewhat suggestive phrase makes you uncomfortable, feel free to mentally replace burning desire with uncontrollable urge, even though its response rate is more along the lines of 3-4%. Now that's got to be a good book, right? Well, right after that, he launches into the real work. All right, enough about how fun it is. What does he teach? He doesn't take it from the perspective of walking through the menus. Instead, he dedicates each section to a specific thing you might want to accomplish, like how to make people look thinner with less wrinkles and whiter teeth. Seriously, this chapter is a must-read. People love my photos. They think they look fabulous. They don't need to know that I fix them up a bit, do you think? There's a chapter on cropping and resizing, which includes a couple of good techniques I now use regularly for straightening photos. This is a critical early learning section because just about every photo we take could be vastly enhanced by good cropping. I take a lot of soccer photos and people are amazed at my photography skills. They don't realize I'm actually a mediocre photographer, but I'm a great cropper. The next couple of chapters are about correcting color and exposure problems. Again, a great enhancement for the mediocre photographer. Next is a section on how to select areas for corrections and enhancements, and an explanation of the mask. I think I could read about masks in about 25 books till I was about 90 years old, and I still wouldn't really understand them, but I'm at least able to work with them now a little bit because of this chapter. Probably the most useful part of this chapter was learning how to use feathering on a section, even after you've made the selection. Feathering is what gives that kind of soft edge to a selection, as you can see in the picture of myself I so narcissistically made into my logo. I created that the day I read the section on featherings in this book. Chapters 7 and 8 are the ones on retouching photos to make your friends and relatives love the way they look. The section that explains how to get rid of wrinkles is so easy and so realistic when you're done. I think I'll do a little lesson on that in a future podcast if you guys are interested. Let me know, okay? There's a chapter on special effects that was fun, but not terribly useful in my everyday life for me anyway. This is where you can learn to change the color of the sky, make a soccer ball look like it's moving when it's not, add sepia to a photo, or make a photo look like a sketch. all fun to play with, but I don't find those techniques all that useful in real life. The chapter on sharpening photos was extremely useful. If nothing else, I learned to add some sharpening to every photo I shrink down to put on the web. I didn't realize just how shrinking a photo would make it less crisp, but you'd really be surprised. I always do it on my photos now that go on the web. He's a big believer that just about every photo will benefit from some level of sharpening. He gives some good formulaic ways of doing sharpening depending on the problem you're trying to fix. And that's a chapter I keep bookmarked and refer back to often, because there's a lot of little toggles and little sliders and stuff to move around in the unsharp mask. Finally, he gives information on how to protect your photos for professional use using watermarks, putting them on the web, and making picture package layouts. The final chapter really is only useful for the Windows users again. The Windows version has a tool called Create, which allows you to create slideshows, calendars, photo websites. Again, all functionality that does come in iPhoto. I suspect this chapter is as informative as the rest. I just didn't have a chance to test it out myself. Overall, I recommend this book highly for its humor and instruction, great visual examples, and practical skills that it taught me. I just looked it up at Amazon, and it turns out there is a Photoshop Elements 4 version out by Mr. Calbi now, which will be definitely good for the Windows users since version 4 isn't out for the Mac yet, but the Windows guys might want to get that book. If you're a Windows user on Photoshop Elements 3 or a Mac user, the book is still out there on Amazon, and both of them are $22, and I put links in the show notes. I really think they're well worth the time to read and learn, even if you scanned and jumped around and didn't take 9 months to read it. Well, that's going to wrap things up for the NosillaCast today. Hopefully you've enjoyed the show. As always, feedback is very welcome at allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.